Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Hope you had a great long weekend. A reminder that you can subscribe to us on Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes. And we have a new newsletter out every morning, The Morning Shots. And all you have to do is subscribe and you get all of the newsletters from The Bulwark. And I try to break that down into quick hits, cheap shots, and deep thoughts. And this will not be a surprise to any of you that listen to me. That I think the strongest part of that that newsletter are the cheap shots, working on the deep thoughts. Joining us today, the first unofficial day of summer when you can wear white shoes if you actually ever do that sort of thing, Matt Lewis, a senior columnist at the Daily Beast, CNN contributor, author, podcast host. You kind of a man of many media, aren't you?
not yet king of all media, but like maybe squire of all media, something.
Well, you sort of have to do all of that. Okay, before we do this, you saw this over the weekend, and I need to just point out that this is not a parody. This is not fake. This is something, and I have to admit I'm fascinated to the point of obsession watching Dr. Seb Gorka standing somewhere in a hallway making a video. This was from, I think it was like Thursday night after the president ordered the declassification of all the information about the Russia investigation. And here is Dr. Seb Gorka, former White House aide, current Salem radio host, talking about how the Kraken has been released. Not a parody.
I knew this day would come, but I didn't expect it so soon. Thanks to the actions and statements of Nancy Pelosi in the last 48 hours, the president has brought forth his decision, and the Kraken has been unleashed. With his decision tonight to allow the Attorney General to declassify any information relating to the illegal surveillance against his presidential campaign and his administration, we will find out who began the biggest political scandal in American history and where the responsibility lies. Watch in the next 2 days, the rats, the hyenas, start to eat each other. Clapper, Brennan, Lynch, even Obama. The fun and games have begun. I'm Sebastian Gorka. Stay tuned. SebGorka.com.
Okay, Matt. I just love listening to that, and you actually have to see the video, and in the back of my mind, I'm always expecting that it's going to be interrupted by, you know, his mom going, "Seb, you've cleaned up your room, haven't you? Don't make me come back there," or something like that. I mean, he's standing there, and you can tell he's probably not wearing pants or anything.
I think one of the best replies is my congressman Don Beyer, a Democrat, who said, he just tweeted over top that and said, "We just want you to start, you know, to quit parking your cars in random places in Arlington." You know, apparently Seb Gorka has a problem of like getting tickets and like just abandoning his car places, or maybe it's his bike. I'm not sure.
But it's the drama there. It's sort of like Seb Gorka obviously was deeply frustrated that there was not a community theater in Hungary or something.
I have to tell you, Charlie, and this might be that I'm, very gullible and earnest, but when I see that, 75% of me is laughing at him as a complete joke, and there's a 25% of me that's a little bit, to be honest with you, a little bit scared, because it's fascistic, the things that he's saying. And thank God we live in a country that has, you know, strong institutions and freedom, but people like Seb Gorka should not be anywhere near the levers of power, and he kind of was, and that is scary.
Well, okay, there is something to we become numbed, and some of this has been normalized. In fact, that phrase has been overused. But here you have the president of the United States himself, and many of his supporters, some of whom are dramatic, some of whom are unhinged, freely using the word treason. That it's not enough to simply, you know, oppose your political enemies. You now have to call them traitors. And in this country, treason carries a death penalty. And you wonder at what point the habit of throwing out words like that, you know, this is a campaign that was built on lock her up. What's next you're going to be, you know, hang them high. This does, you know, to put it mildly, coarsen the political dialogue, but also sort of insert something into our politics that is disturbing, which is that we don't simply have debates or elections, that we have to destroy our enemies and treat our enemies as enemies of the people and as traitors. And I guess I share with you, you laugh and roll your eyes about it. And then you go, all right, this is creepy stuff. You even have Liz Cheney over the weekend using the word, you have a congresswoman, daughter of the former vice president, using words like treason on national television. And it's like, wait, we've crossed some line here.
No, that's exactly what I was going to say about like the insidious nature of it. I mean, nobody is, by virtue of her name, I mean, the vice president's daughter. And then, she had that Fox News platform for a long time, too, on Fox News Sunday, which is a more august platform than just doing cable hits. This is somebody who is like, by definition, an establishment figure. And for her to go there, I think demonstrates just how pervasive and insidious this idea is. And that makes it super dangerous.
And of course, this is the Tuesday after just another weekend in Trump world. The President of the United States goes off to Japan on foreign soil, praises one of the bloodiest dictators in the world, uses his words to bash a political opponent, Joe Biden, and cuts his own national security aides off at the knees. And it's probably only the number two or three story of the week. It's so quaint reading these stories about the time, in the distant past when foreign policy and politics stopped at the water's edge, just another norm absolutely trashed.
And I think it's sort of like the big lie, when we're now in this chaos theory. And like at some point, once you've flooded the zone with so much norm breaking stuff, people can't keep up. And eventually the standards really erode. And I think that's where we are. If he had just dipped his toes over the line, it would have been more dangerous for him. But by virtue of like going all in, in a way, it's sort of nothing. If everything's insane, nothing's insane.
That's true. There was a moment even on Fox News where some of the pundits were going, yeah, standing there in Japan attacking Joe Biden, while you're essentially quoting, Kim about your Democratic opponent, not good form, not a winning strategy. But again, here we are on Tuesday, and are we talking about that? Are we going to be talking about lots of other things? Well, of course, we're going to. By the way, have you seen Dinesh D'Souza's Twitter feed? Speaking of like the normalization of the abnormal.
I try not to, but
well, this is getting a little bit ahead of ourselves because this is going to be the big story later this week. The historian David Garrow has this very, very lengthy piece about, based on the FBI tapes of Martin Luther King Jr., that suggests that his treatment of women was, I'm not going to say Harvey Weinstein level because I think that would be unfair, but had, affairs with as many as 40 women and allegedly actually witnessed a rape by one of his colleagues. I mean, really, really nasty stuff. And Garrow, of course, is Pulitzer Prize winning historian, one of the iconic chroniclers of the civil rights movement. And this has been published in a relatively, I shouldn't say this because I've never heard of it, lower profile British magazine, but the London Times broke the story about it. And of course you have, RT, you have the Russian trolls, you have the Dinesh D'Souza's who are going, see, here's this liberal icon. And they're going to turn it around and say, well, how can you criticize Donald Trump for his character? And it's going to be a week of really messy, tedium, hypocrisy, and finger pointing.
Yeah, no, look, and I think, historically speaking, there were a lot of people who did a lot of bad things. We just didn't know about it. I mean, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon. We found out about some of Nixon stuff, but FDR. But I think part of what, and look, so part of the truth is that our elites were always had failings and were complex figures. But I do think there's a difference between them and Trump still, because Trump revels in his debauchery. And, they tried to keep things under wraps. Like, I'm not saying that made them a good person,
it didn't demand that we accept their behavior.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of that was they had a media that was kind of complicit in helping them cover things up or certainly not reporting everything that was known. But I think some of it also was just there was a sense of decorum and shame that is now absent. And certainly Donald Trump is very shameless. In fact, I think that's one of his superpowers, is shamelessness.
Okay, you know what? Okay, this is a bad segue. And I'm going to just admit it is a bad segue, but I was thinking about this whole question of how do you evaluate someone's character? Do you base it on the worst things they did on the worst day that they had? And we'll talk about Martin Luther King Jr. later.
Let's talk about Bill Buckner. If
that's
you're
exactly
go there.
Where I was going. See, the great minds think alike. I was going right. I was going from a civil rights icon to a baseball player. And whether Bill Buckner, should have been defined by that one missed play. And, this is really it's almost a perfect example of sort of meditating on that, thinking about what his career was like, how successful he was through all of those years. And yet he was going to inevitably be remembered by that one missed grounder. But also, the moment where the Red Sox fans, who are not known for being forgiving, actually forgave him. It's a hell of a story, isn't it?
It really is. And you said it was a bad segue or transition, but the fact that I jumped ahead and interrupted you shows that either you and I are both weird or it was a natural segue. Look, there's a great piece in the Boston Globe today that points out Bill Buckner had more big league hits than either Joe DiMaggio or Ted Williams. Look, I mean, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics, and I'm not saying that makes Bill Buckner better than them. But this is a guy who was an incredible ball player, a real pro, borderline Hall of Fame numbers, and was defined by – he shouldn't have been out there, injured, but a huge moment. Everybody's watching it. It was Mookie Wilson dribbles that ground ball down the first baseline. It goes through his legs, and that becomes – the defining moment of his life. It was still, despite everything and the forgiveness, it's still in the first line of his obituary. And that, if you think about it, it's the Me Too moment. And do we ever forgive people? And do we let the worst moment of someone's life define them? God knows, I would not want, if someone captured the worst moment of my life, I wouldn't want that to be the only thing, the thing that my kids know about, right? I mean, everybody has good moments and bad moments. I think the totality of his career is incredibly good. And let's go back to our current president. I don't think it's just the Access Hollywood tape, right? That's not the one incident. There is a never-ending barrage of bad low moments in Donald Trump's career and life.
Yeah, it's the difference between someone's career, I mean, someone's character as it's been formed over decades versus a bad choice or a bad moment that somebody might have had. And I do think that we can all make mistakes. Look, I mean, I think part of the reason why the Bill Buckner story speaks to us all is that we're all potentially Bill Buckner, right? I mean, you're on live TV. I'm on live TV. There's a possibility that someday we will do something horrific, and we do not want to be remembered for that one moment in our lives. So, by the way, I know you give talks about to young people, advising them how to be pundits and things like that. Do you ever warn them about the one bad tweet, the one bad moment, how you're always, one click away from blowing yourself up?
Oh, yeah, all the time. And one of the first, so I just did this at the Leadership Institute, which is a great organization. I actually worked there for 4 years, interned there before that. And so it's a day-long seminar workshop on how to become – well, the original title was How to Be an Opinion Leader, and nobody knew what that meant, and it sounds a little bit stodgy. So we changed it to How to Be a Pundit, which kind of sounds more douchey. But the first hour-long sort of talk is really a lot about character and integrity and how it's not just to go viral, but it's to have a career doing this and to stay relevant but also respected. And putting both of those things together is incredibly important. And I do warn about the danger of Twitter and how much of a double-edged sword it is. I think you kind of need to be on there, sadly. But I think I have to be, but it's also incredibly dangerous and toxic. But I will say that I think Trump's success and the success of the Trump era of other imitators makes my message harder. My warnings to people about character and wisdom and things like that it doesn't resonate as much as it used to, because people were like, okay, old man, you know, that's just old values. They don't work anymore, man.
Well, and you think about what the business model is right now and what the incentives are. You know, if you're a young person, you're thinking, God, how do I get on Fox News? How do I get on, you know, One America Now or something? You know, how do I go viral? And unfortunately, we have a reward system that will reward some of the, you know.
We had one young lady there who is going to go probably be at One America News. Is it OAN? That's it, right?
One America News.
Yeah. Now? I don't know. Anyway, that's the kind of thing. And then I tell them a story. I tell them lots of stories of my career. I mean, there were times when I like inadvertently offended people, like producers, like the time I was, I think I'm still blacklisted from Neil Cavuto's Fox News show. So what happened is, I'll tell you the story real quick. When Sarah Palin announced she was going to resign from governor of Alaska, it happened like on, I think it was July 3rd. And this is back before everybody was on Twitter. So I had edited a book of Palin's quotes, and I was on Twitter. Not everybody was. And I kind of caught wind early on of the fact that this was coming down the pike. Palin later today was going to have this announcement. But it still wasn't corroborated. But then I started seeing like an Anchorage NPR reporter talking about it. So I emailed all my producers at Fox and I said, hey, I'm in town. It's July 3rd. And I think Palin's going to announce this big announcement. And let me know if you'd like me to come on. And then I waited like 10 minutes and nothing. Didn't get. So I emailed MSNBC and they jumped at it. They wanted me on. They sent a car. I'm in a car. I'm crossing the 14th Street Bridge. I get a call from Neil Cavuto's producer saying, hey, we want you on. And I said, I'm sorry. I've committed to someone else. And she said, well, we'll just cancel it. And I said, well, to be honest with you, I'm in a car heading to the studio. And she says, well, get out of the car. And I said, I was going to say, like, well, I mean, I love you guys, but,
this
you know, but
producer.
I was saying that. I just hear the click and I hear like the tone, you know, the phone die and never been back on. So that's the kind of story that I share with them is like, even if you try to be a good person and do everything right, like be very careful of mistakes you can make in this business.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are so many, and those producers and those schedulers are very, very powerful. But this producer was obviously an A-level producer that she was really pressuring you to get out of that car.
I mean, and this is before I got banned by blacklisted by Fox in general. That happened later. But this is just one show. So I have a lot. Let's just say I have a lot of advice and mistakes that I've made along the way. I mean, in this case, I don't think I made a mistake. I think I did the right thing. But in other cases, I have to admit, there were times where there's like certain protocols that you may not know about if you're not in this industry. And there were mistakes that I made where I didn't handle things appropriately. And I try to pass on that kind of advice to people who are aspiring political commentators.
So speaking of aspiring political commentators, and right before we started the podcast, I mentioned to you that I had just stumbled upon your piece that you wrote about Katie McHugh. And we had a kind of interesting conversation about this piece. She is the young woman who briefly was a minor star in some of the right-wing media, conservative media. And you knew her at one point, and you wrote a piece, a very thoughtful piece. I knew Katie McHugh was a racist. Did I enable her? A little bit of background for listeners. We actually devoted a whole podcast to this story when we had Rosie Gray from BuzzFeed on. She did this very in-depth feature about this young woman and how she got sucked into this vortex of alt-right white nationalism, anti-Semitism, and now is trying to sort of make good. But it's an extraordinary story of a bright young woman who somehow, you know, whether she thought this was her path to you know, fame and glory and clicks or whatever, fell in with a very, very dangerous crowd. And so you tell me a little bit about your story, and you kind of were kind of a little bit feeling, you know, did you miss something?
Yeah, well, first let me say, Rosie Gray did an amazing job writing this great journalism piece, and I read it and I started feeling, maybe not guilty is not the right word. I mean, I'm not culpable, but did I do enough as an adult to try to help Katie? And I'm thinking of it from that standpoint. I'm sure a lot of people are like, why are you trying to help Katie? She's the one with the problem. Yeah, that's true. She's probably hurt a lot of other people, but I'm thinking of it like sort of maybe an in loco parentis sort of thing. I was an adult working at a media outlet, and she was a young aspiring journalist, and so I thought Rosie did a great job, and I was starting to feel a little bad about the fact that I didn't do more to sort of speak out and try to help Katie. And then I went for a jog, and I heard you interviewing Rosie. I think it was that interview. I forget, but you were talking to someone, and I think it was you, Charlie, who said, like, it's too bad there weren't any adults who intervened. And I was like really kicking myself. And that's what compelled me to write my piece.
Well, see, that was my question. You wonder at, you know, this is where thought leadership comes in. This is where being a role model is important, where you take somebody and you steer them, you know, away from the Joe Sobrans and the Daily Stormers. You steer them toward, hey, why don't you read a little bit more, you know, Hayek, or why don't you read a little bit more Buckley? And this never happened. So
yeah,
you were listening to that podcast. Okay, so let's go back to this. You worked at the same time at the Daily Caller for a while.
Let me just talk about that for a second, because it's, and I wrote a piece years ago at the, you could read it today at the Daily Caller, and it's titled something like, How the Daily Caller is Like the Old Oakland Raiders. And I got this idea. I was reading Chuck Klosterman has a book called I Wear the Black Hat. And he was talking about the Oakland Raiders as sort of a villain. And he comes to the conclusion that, like, the Oakland Raiders weren't feared and hated because they were evil or bad, or because they, you know, because they didn't follow the rules. It was that they allowed intellectual honesty, and they didn't police off the field behavior. And so I wrote a piece at the Daily Caller saying that's pretty much what we are. Now, it's super interesting, because if you look at the Daily Caller, and I mean, I haven't been there for a few years, but during the time I was there, I mean, I worked with Chris Moody, who like went to CNN and Yahoo, Tina Nguyen, who's now at Vanity Fair, Caitlin Collins, who's now a big time like CNN, you know, on air reporter, Will Ron, you know, Jamie Weinstein. I mean, it was just Alexis Levinson, who went to like Roll Call and BuzzFeed and National Review. So there was like, it was a really great training ground for young, I don't even want to say center right journalists. Some of these people aren't even center right. They're just journalists. And I didn't even name all the names I could, but there were also other types of people there. And I think part of the ethos was maybe like a don't ask, don't tell. Like, you don't tell me what to write. If I want to write an open borders piece, I'm using air quotes. But if I want to write a piece, I like advocated strongly for immigration reform in 2014 at the Daily Caller. Nobody said a word to me. Nobody cared, because it was kind of like, you do your thing. And, you know, look, I had kids. I was coming to the office at 8. I was like writing a book on their time. You know, they were totally cool with that. And then I would leave at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But one of the things I did try to pride myself on was at least being available and mentoring the young journalists there. And in some cases, the interns. And Katie just happened to be there one summer, where we had a great intern class, actually, and a big intern class. And I think I went out to lunch at the end of it with every single one of them, including Katie. We sat outside at PJ Clark's, and I mean, I'll paraphrase the conversation, but it basically went like this. I asked her, like, why is it, who are your heroes? And she said, like, I like Pat Buchanan. And I said, well, why is it that people think he's an anti-Semite? And she said, well, that's because the Jews control the media. And I said, like, check, please, you know, basically. But then that was her last day, and I just thought she was going to go away, and maybe she was joking. But I should have said something right then and there, and she ended up getting hired. Nobody asked me like what I thought about it, if they should hire her, but they ended up hiring her. And then she worked there for like a year as an editor. I don't even know if I ever spoke to her during that time, and I certainly didn't pull her aside and say, Katie, listen, You're going down a bad path here. Let me help you. I didn't do that, and I should have.
Well, you know, this is the question, because we all went through this on sort of a macro level of the people in the movement who had crazy ideas. And, you know, and you kind of rolled your eyes, you kind of shrugged your shoulders about it, you know, but, you know, I don't know. There was, I think every one of us has that moment where you go, I should have intervened. I should have said something when there was still time. And then we didn't. Right. You know?
Yeah. It's like a drug addict or an alcoholic. And you never know. Yeah. It's like you always think, well, maybe they'll work it out themselves. You know, I don't want to butt in. It's not my place to do it.
Yeah, well, and as you point out, you don't know whether she would have listened because there's that incentive structure in the right-wing media that leads people down these paths. And she went where that incentive structure is. But again, you just don't know whether or not.
And I think that, it would have, you know, I think it would have mattered when I intervened. If I had intervened early on, I think I'd had a better shot than later on after she had this, apparently, I didn't know at the time, but she had this like infrastructure and was dating like an alt-righter type. But I do think that I should have given it a shot, and I regret that I didn't, because I think I failed her. I mean, I don't think I had necessarily a responsibility to do it. Like, I was never her manager. I was never her editor, but I was an adult. And honestly, one of the reasons that the caller hired me was, to be kind of, you know, like if you have a ball club, you want to have that one veteran on the bench, you know, and in the clubhouse. And I mean, Tucker is a very busy person. He wasn't really around all the time. And part of my reason for being there, and it's funny that I was in my 30s and I was a veteran, but it's sort of like being on, it was like I was Crash Davis, you know, on a baseball team. And
well, sure. When you're 19 years old and you're 19 years old and you're an intern, you know, the person in their 30s who, you know, actually has a job is like, you know, I mean, that's like, you know, George Will.
Totally.
To her.
Totally. And so I was, if people came to me, I always would talk to them and give them advice. My door was always open. I would go, but what I didn't do was sort of insert myself into the situation. And I don't know how that would have been received by her or by management. But what I know is that I didn't try, and I regret that I didn't try to do that.
Well, you know, I thought about this a lot. You know, the number of times when I encountered people who were drifting off into some weird conspiracy world, and for a while, to the extent that I did engage, and I didn't always engage, you know, and tried to push back. Hey, you really don't want to be doing this. You don't want to be reading this stuff, or this is really sick, racist stuff. And you know, here's something else that you should, you know, here's a more appropriate way of doing it. It felt like it worked for a while. Until, you know, like 2015, 2014, 2015, 2016, where the environment changed so dramatically, where there were so many little holes that people could go into to, you know, feed the darker angels of their nature. And it became harder and harder to do that. And then, of course, you know, in the current era, it feels like, you know, all of that has been undone. But it still shocks me, for example, you know, when I read stories like this, is I don't think, maybe it's certainly a sign of my age, to think of young people growing up being this virulently racist. I mean, that seems like something from the distant past, you know?
Yeah. And that's part of why I didn't see it, I think, because I had naively assumed things were going to get better on that front.
Well, exactly. It's like something that you thought was, you know, from an old movie in the 1940s or the 1950s. So when these kids from Turning Point USA show up in these videos screaming the N-word, I'm thinking, I have no idea this was out there, which is, okay, maybe a confession of my naivete or the denialism or something. But, you know, you knew that these things were out there. You just didn't think it was going to come from a smart sounding young person.
Yeah, that's part of it. It used to be, this I think is part of what Richard Spencer was trying to do with the word alt-right, is make these old-fashioned and uncool ideas seem cool. And I think to some degree that they have succeeded. There was a time, like when I was a kid, if you were like a white supremacist or a racist, you were like a stereotypical dumb Southerner. You know, you were not the kind of person who was cool. You were not the kind of person that like got chicks. You were not hip, for lack of a hip word. And that actually has changed, because there is this subculture. And so I think that's part of the problem with me talking to someone like Katie, right? It used to be you could go to them and have an intervention, and you really had a two-pronged approach. There was this is wrong morally and ethically, right? But then B, this is career suicide. You're going to be, you know, you're going to be a loser. You're not going to be able to like get a job. You're not going to be, people are going to think that you're whatever. And sadly, I think that, that doesn't really work anymore. I mean, in their minds, this is probably a smart career move for them. Now, as it turns out, I think the thing I really liked about the Katie story is it's a cautionary tale. And I think if you read the Rosie piece, it doesn't glamorize her. And by any means, it's a cautionary, chilling tale.
Oh, it's very much a chilling tale. And you would hope that even, you know, people who've gotten into the Charlie Kirk, Candace Owens orbit are going to look around and going, okay, you know, I may get the short term buzz hit out of this, but long term, this is a career suicide. If in fact it is a career suicide. Let's switch gears a little bit because you have a piece out about Beto O'Rourke, and I am fascinated by, I think, some of the things that you are fascinated by, which includes the incredibly rapid decline of this superstar. You know, it's a guy who was on the cover of Vanity Fair magazine like 5 minutes ago, and now he feels like, I mean, he is seriously cold product.
Well, yes, except for the fact that there is a rehabilitation effort right now. There's an attempt to do a Beto relaunch, and so I don't know if it's the New York Times or where, but there's a piece out today basically, Beto's back, baby, you know. And I think part of it is that
he's got an HBO documentary starting, right?
Oh, is that it? He's got a lot of the Obama bros. A lot of the Obama bros are behind him. So, like, I mean, they still have a lot of, you know, cachet in the liberal movement. So he's not going to go quietly. They're going to try to retool him. But I mean, I think that he made a fundamental error, which is, assuming that the buzz in Texas was transferable, then he sort of wasted a lot of time and undermined his image, like during that brief interregnum between running for Senate and running for president. And then I think he allowed Pete Buttigieg to outmaneuver him and take that space as the young, hope and change, likable candidate. And so I think maybe Beto, maybe there's a relaunch, but I feel like he's really missed a window of opportunity that he had.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing when you're running against one of the most disliked members of the United States Senate, when then everyone loves you. I mean, running against Ted Cruz, everybody loves you, as opposed to being one of, what, 58 Democrats that are running. I made that number up, obviously. He's just sort of another guy. You said that he let Mayor Pete take that lane away from him. I'm not sure that he could have done anything about it, because I think what Mayor Pete, you know, did was stands up and frankly, he's so much more substantive and interesting than Beto O'Rourke. And sort of, you know, Beto O'Rourke, you know, maybe had reached his glass ceiling in terms of this is all you got. Whereas Mayor Pete's an interesting, rather complex character.
Yeah. I mean, you may be right there, because I think Mayor Pete is so formidable and such a good political athlete that he would have eventually been able to think there's a niche for the young Obama-esque inspiring guy, and I think just Pete Buttigieg is better at that shtick than Beto is, but certainly if you went back 6 months ago and said like Pete who, like, we wouldn't even know who Pete was, and right. You would have said Beto. If Beto ran that race, I mean, I'm not saying he would have won. Joe Biden's formidable, but if Beto had run as that guy right away, maybe he keeps Pete out. I don't know. I think Buttigieg has certainly a lot of incentive to get in, and he's formidable. But yeah. I think that Beto, I just don't know his lane, right? Because I think that would have been the lane. And I think number one, here's the thing. It's not that – so Pete Buttigieg is better at it than him, but I don't feel like he even had to go head-to-head against Beto. Beto basically, I think, surrendered that path.
No, that's what I think. He sort of exposed himself that there wasn't any there. And I think that's part of the problem. You know, moving from a Senate election to the national stage is kind of an exponential leap. And I don't think he was ready for that. And he didn't have the substance. And he doesn't have this. He really just comes off as a, I don't know, he Look, I say this as somebody who I'm sure on cable television once or twice must have said if he gets in the race, he's a top three contender. He's immediately a front runner. And then, of course, he does. And, well, we've seen this before.
I thought so, too. I mean, I thought Beto – here's the deal. There's a window of opportunity for these guys, right? And so Obama seized that moment and made it to the top, right? It worked for him. And then Chris Christie didn't. Christie should have run in 2012, and I think he missed his window. But by the same token, you know, just because you get in and strike while the iron is hot doesn't mean you're ready. And so I think that Obama was ready. Palin wasn't, you know, and there are differences between the two. She was sort of air dropped in the middle of a race. She didn't have the time to ramp up, but she wasn't ready. And I think Beto just doesn't have it. And I think Pete Buttigieg does.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And of course, we've seen this happen a lot of times before. I mean, I thought that, remember, I'm old enough to remember when Fred Thompson was the guy. As soon as Fred Thompson gets in that race, that everything changes. And like, yeah, how long did that last? You know, a few weeks?
I even think Rubio is somebody who, you know, sort of a young, at the time, young up-and-coming conservative, originally a Tea Party guy. I was really excited about Rubio, and I don't hate Rubio. I still like him, but I do think that he wasn't ready. In hindsight, it demonstrates that he wasn't ready for prime time, and some people are and some people aren't. And the thing is, it's almost like drafting a quarterback. Impossible. Remember, Tom Brady's like what, the sixth round draft pick, right? You got these guys who are Heisman Trophy winners, first round draft pick, and you think they're going to be in the NFL for 20 years and they flame out in a season, you know, and you've got the best scouts and the best analytics and the Moneyball people. They don't know. They don't know who is ready or not. And I think that's how these presidential candidates are. Until you get on the campaign trail, you don't know for sure. And I think that's the case with trying to judge somebody like Beto.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. You know, I'm just running through my mind all the people who were exposed instantaneously and sometimes by being too successful, you know, bursting to the top. But you know, really the exception to this rule is frankly Barack Obama. Is that Barack Obama came out of nowhere and, you know, on paper should not have been ready for prime time. And in fact, he turned out to be ready for prime time in an extraordinary way. So,
He rose to the occasion. He also learned on the way. I mean, I think he had something like 20 debates against Hillary Clinton, and he got better along the way. And he did well enough that he didn't embarrass himself. But he learned as he went and progressed. And that's why I do have an asterisk. Earlier, I said Palin, and I think Palin was exposed for being very charismatic but not being ready for prime time. And then, of course, she became radicalized and became a victim, made herself into a victim and all that. But if you go back to 08, I do think the thing is she didn't run for president. I mean, if you know that you're going to run for president in a couple years, you start – theoretically, you would start boning up on the issues, and then you would sort of dip your toes in the water, right? You would ease yourself in the water. She was thrown in the deep end, and so I'll give her a little more grace than I would give someone like Beto, let's say.
Okay, so since you brought up Sarah Palin, because I have a small obsession about this as well. I remember right before the Wisconsin primary back in 2016, she came down and spoke in West Allis as a surrogate for Trump. And the people in the room, I think, almost universally recognized they were watching one of the worst political performances ever. I mean, it was awful. It was the worst speech I've ever heard. And it was so bad that I actually went home and my wife and I sat in the kitchen and we pulled up her acceptance speech from 2008. And I wanted to sort of look at them side by side and ask the question.
It's like a different person.
Well, exactly. What the hell happened? No, this person is not the same. Did something happen to her? Is she doing something? Or was she never all that? Were we just basically, you make somebody up, you put them up, you give them a good speechwriter's lines. So what the hell happened to Sarah Palin? Because, I mean, you look back on her and a lot of us thought she was the rising star. And now you look back and realize she was kind of the proto-Trump, the real dumbing down of the Republican Party. I mean, you're the guy that wrote the book, you know, Too Dumb to Fail. I mean, that's like, you know, it's right on her forehead.
It's stunning what happened to her. People forget because she became such a joke, but people forget. Watch the speech when John McCain picks her, the day he picks her and announces her. She hits it out of the park. Go back and watch the 2008 Republican convention speech in Minneapolis. She hits a home run. Go back and watch her debate against Joe Biden. She certainly held her own. Three of the biggest moments that you would theoretically supposed to have. Now, again, this is the Bill Buckner moment is Katie Couric. And there were some Bill Buckner moments as well. But she was an incredible political talent, incredibly charismatic. And I think that what happened is that she was artificially elevated, obviously, by virtue of being selected, not elected. And then she was dropped without time to ramp up into the middle of this race. And during that time, I think that it destroyed her. I think that it broke her. I think it broke her is the word I would use. And then I think it radicalized her. And I think she became the victim, started playing the victim card. And now I think she is like one of those one-hit wonders that is now washed up. And you know, you see them playing at some dive bar. And they used to be filling arenas. And it's actually kind of sad.
Well, it is. And I agree with you. I just wonder whether she's more damaged than just broken. And then I know I'm getting into dangerous territory because, I mean, she's so bad now. In fact, you look at some of the clown show of the Trump administration. I mean, we're bringing in the Seb Gorkas of the world and all of these other, you know, misfit toys. And yet she apparently was deemed to be too crazy, too out there. Even for Trump in the early days. So they saw something there that's almost beyond because it's so appalling to compare the two. And again, I don't want to speculate what it is, but she's clearly broken and it is clearly pathetic and sad.
Yeah. And this sort of overlaps my How to Be a Pundit workshop, you know, where I talk to people about. And by the way, if it sounds like I'm plugging it, I'm not, because it already happened. And I don't know when I have no idea when the next one's going to happen. But one of the things we talk about is sort of finding your niche and like, why would people read you or listen to you as a commentator? And obviously having some expertise might help. Right. If you've been to China, you speak Mandarin, then
you know something. Yeah.
You're a China expert, but whatever the case may be, like, everybody has a brand and should have a brand. And so, like, one of the things Jonah Goldberg talks about a lot, which I teach at this class, is like, if your brand is being young, you're in trouble. Like if you're like, I'm the millennial person covering the campaign for MSNBC or Fox or CNN, and that's my brand. And like, if you do that, fine, you could break into the business that way, but you better very quickly transition from, because if your stock and trade is being young, that is going to expire. And I think if it's hotness, if it's like, if you get on TV because you're good looking, and I know, Charlie, you and I have played that card. Certainly, you and I have gotten on because we're hot, but then we learned something. But I think part of the problem with Palin is, if your thing is that you're going to be the craziest SOB out there, to paraphrase, was it Thomas Massey who said that?
Yes, right.
If your thing is, I'm going to go rogue. I'm going to be the one who goes rogue. I'm going to be the one who tells it like it is.
Yeah, you got to go
rogue
all the time.
You can be outmaneuvered by – there are now hundreds and hundreds of younger Sarah Palins who know as much or less than her but are younger – and more rogue than she is. How does she compete with them? She doesn't have any unique selling proposition, right? They can always out crazy her. And so that's a problem. And I think she opened the door to that. She should have gone back to Alaska. She should have boned up on the issues. She could have actually been formidable, and she went the easy, cheap route instead.
She certainly did. Well, Matt Lewis, again, thank you so much for coming back. This is your second appearance on the Bulwark podcast. Second one?
I don't know who I'm tied with, but
the reason I'm asking is I'm thinking, okay, because this is the successor of the Daily Standard podcast, and I sometimes confuse the two, you know, because it's kind of, I won't say seamless, but so, you know, people who've been on the Daily Standard podcast, I say, well, thanks for coming back, when in fact this is their first appearance on the Bulwark podcast, but you were on the Bulwark podcast. So thanks a lot. I appreciate it very much, Matt.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.